When deciding to open a brewery, Doug Constantiner weighed his options and concluded that being around some of the best and world-class breweries in the USA was a must. Join us as this former finance guy gives us a history of moving into the beer world, his experience he learned at the brewery in Green Flash, and what 10 years of West Coast IPAs has done for his brand and his love for beer. We would be what we would call the pupils in this interview as he teaches us the finer things that is San Diego beer. This show is sponsored by Zatuna Liquor in Rochester Hills, North Center Brewing in Northville, Michigan, and the upcoming Burning Foot Beer Festival tickets are still on sale today.
Whether your beer is in a bottle, can, or glass, kick back and relax. It's Better on Draft.
Welcome, everybody. This is episode 295 of the Better on Draft podcast. My name is Ken. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Just as a heads up, if you are listening and waiting, we will not have a news segment this week. Stay tuned to our TikTok. That's at Better on Draft on TikTok to get some updates on news throughout the next coming weeks, as it'll be a few weeks before we get back to the news because we have plenty of guests that we're bringing you over the upcoming weeks. With that in mind, let's go over and see what everybody is drinking. For myself, real quick, I have got a nice little bottle of Ghetto Blaster, compliments of Motor City Brewing Works, and I'm going to wash it down with a Shock Top Belgian White. Tito, what do you got?
I am drinking a Mr. Blue Sky Michigan Cherry Wheat Ale from Griffin Claw Brewing Company, and I'm going to wash that down, like you said, with a Magic Hat number 9.
Sounds delicious. Wendy, what do you got?
Well, I'm going a little light today, and I picked up a barrel-aged, old-fashioned, ready-to-drink cocktail from my recent trip to Bardstown from the Bardstown Brewing Company.
Awesome. And with us in our Zoom studio, we have Doug from Society Brewing. Why don't you introduce yourself and give us a rundown of what you do at the brewery?
Sure. So, Doug Constantiner. I'll give my beer, too.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm drinking a Society Harlot. It's a Belgian blonde ale, and I'm going to be washing it down with another harlot. So I'm the CEO, founder CEO here at Society Brewing Company. 10 years in now here in San Diego. So basically my duties are running the operations of the company and really overseeing the philosophy and making sure that we're executing on our business plans. But prior to that, I used to be a brewer. I worked at Green Flash, OG's, which is a small brew pub here in San Diego, Pizza Port, and the brewery in Orange County. So I was one of the original employees there. And not first employees, but I was there in the early days before it exploded and became this like huge thing. So that was a lot of fun to be a part of that. But Society, we're California only. About 80% of our beer is sold in San Diego. We do cans and draft, known for our IPA, the Pupil. It's a pretty highly sought after IPA, but it's a year round beer. And that's kind of why we made Society is that beer should be available for everybody and year round, not a brewery that does special releases or anything like that.
Real quick, just to help me understand, because I think here in Michigan, we don't know necessarily what happened, with a little bit of cliff notes. Green Flash is reopened. Is that correct over there?
They were. They had some financial struggles, so somebody had bought them out. And then now they got acquired. The name got acquired by Sweetwater from Atlanta. The facility, though, is up for sale. So I think Sweetwater is making their beer right now.
Thank you so much. Because we were aware that they closed, but then I went to their website and they were selling things. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And I went to Untappd and people were checking in the beer.
Yeah, there's still beer on the shelves. They own Alpine Brewing Company, too. So the brewery's still operational. I think they're just looking for a buyer.
Thank you for that. Now, if you listen to any of Doug's interviews on the internet, and he's done a handful, he always talks about the times when he was growing up and getting in trouble with his drinking under the age of 21. Now, people don't know, but his mother was more upset at the beer that he was drinking and not the fact that he was drinking. And I think that's what a lot of good mothers and fathers do, is that they know they can't stop you from drinking. But I want to know, after listening to this interview, I've heard the story a handful of times. What does your mother like to drink? Before we get into you, I want to know what is the styles your mother likes to drink?
She drinks tequila.
Oh.
She, when she comes to the brewery, she'll have a couple tasters of beer, but she loves tequila. So if it came to beer, she likes Belgian dark strongs. She drinks, we have a beer called The Widow, and that's what she likes.
Well, going back to that time in your younger days, you mentioned in these interviews that your first time you were homebrewing was during college. What were some of the first styles that you started brewing down there?
The very first style, I remember it was a stout. Stouts are really the beers that got me into craft beer and chasing after that kind of flavor. I always loved chocolate my whole life, and I tasted a chocolate stout from Rogue Brewing Company called Rogue Chocolate Stout, and I was like, this is the great beer, can taste like chocolate. I knew exactly what I wanted to do the rest of my life. So brewed some stouts, obviously tried some hoppy stuff. And the early aughts, IPAs weren't that big, so you could make one, but it things like, you know, Pliny the Elder, they didn't have the recipes published. So you would just kind of throw everything you could at it. But it was a lot of stouts, a lot of English beers. The American way of brewing is very much based on the British way of brewing with the single infusion mash. So it kind of just made sense to do that and keep it simple. And then Belgians, of course, because that was the way for me to learn yeast and how yeast can really express itself as a flavor versus trying to use a yeast that's really neutral and doesn't speak that much. And, you know, with American ales, specifically IPAs, pale ales, everyone uses, or I should say everyone, but it's very popular to use Cal Ale or Chico, which is Sierra Nevada, where that yeast really lets the ingredients outside of the yeast talk. It's super neutral. So I like doing English ales, and Belgian ales. Those were my favorite. I really didn't dabble in anything hoppy as a home brewer.
Now, that's as a brewer, but when you get outside of the brewery, your brewery, for example, and you go to a different brewery, you go to a different area, a different city, what's the first style that you're looking for? Is it that, are you looking for a Belgian style? Are you looking for a stout, or are you looking for something more clean and crisp?
No, this isn't the answer you want, but it depends. You know, if I go to a brewery that's known for lagers, I want to taste their lagers and what they're proud of. There's a famous brewery in the South called it's a Duck Rabbit. You know, they're known for stouts. So I'm not going to go there and order a Czech Pils. I want to see what they're proud of. If it's a brewery that kind of does everything, I'll start with an IPA. I live in the land of IPAs, so I just always like to see how, you know, we match up to other people across the country and the world.
So first I have to ask, are you sure you're not an engineer? Because you just gave the engineer answer. It depends.
I'm not an engineer, at least. No. I'd be, no. No, I'm not an engineer.
So I love the idea of a brewery having a rally cry. You know, yours is Beer Folks Unite. But I really do just love the whole idea of the inclusion nature of Society Brand. Can you give us a little history on how that came about?
Yeah. So, I mean, it says it on our can, Society. This brewery was named because beer's for everyone in society. I used to do investment banking, and I was at a dinner. We had raised a bunch of money for a company, and we go out and have this really expensive dinner as a celebration. And there's multiple, you know, $100 bottles, $1,000 bottles of wine on the table. People are getting really nice scotch, and I order a Chimay Blue, and people looked at me funny, like, what is this, you know, beer that comes in a chalice? And it kind of hit me that night that, like, I could be drinking some really high end stuff that costs a lot of money that everyone else is drinking, but I got a beer for $8. And to me, that was like the greatest thing I could drink that night for $8. And that's kind of when it hit me that, you know, beer is not about being wine or being scotch or being truffles or anything like that, that really excludes a lot of people financially. The best beer in the world for me is the beer you want to drink every single day that's available on the shelf and is affordable. You don't have to be a member of a club. There's no wait list to get into the club, and nothing against that at all. But that's not what I loved about beer. What I loved about beer is that for $5, you can get the best beer in the world, the Desert Island beer. A lot of people say Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. I mean, a six pack costs $10. So you're what is that, a buck 80? Now I'm going to embarrass myself with math, but whatever it is, it's, it doesn't matter. I mean, it should be affordable. So if someone's into wine, like I'm into beer, and they're blue collar, working class, they're never going to get access to the greatest wines of all time, because there's a part of a lot of things outside of beer that you have to have a lot of money to afford it. And that really pissed me off. I think that is just the most ridiculous thing of all time. And to be able to make a product that anybody can afford. When I started Society, down the street from us, there's a famous bar that they sold Pliny the Elder for $5.25 a pint. But 12 years ago, say what you will about it now, I still love it, for the record. I think it's incredible. But 12 years ago, it was ranked one of the best beers of all time. You could get it for $5.25. You can't say that about anything else. So that's Society. Doesn't matter if you're a corporate executive, if you're a plumber, you're a musician, you can afford the best. And that's what I love about beer. And that's what Society is. It is the most inclusive, the least exclusive thing. And that's really what we want to do with Society. I mean, that's why we call it Society. It's beer is for everyone in society. No one's too good for beer, and beer is not too good for anyone. And I can't say that about anything else. Sorry.
That's I totally agree. Cause I honestly, just to give you a quick example, just like the beer that Ken's drinking at Ghetto Blast, the first time I had it, it was a $3 pint. And I was blown away that this was only $3. So I've been drinking it ever since. So I think Wendy has a quick question for you.
I do. So I was today years old when I learned how to pronounce the name of your brewery. So I was just curious where the name came about, like this particular spelling.
The spelling was so we could trademark it and make it look unique. The idea of beers for everyone in society kind of made sense to call it Society, but I kind of wanted to stand out, and yeah, mispronunciations happen all the time. And it's kind of silly, because when I worked at the brewery, B-R-U-E-R-Y, I said, one day I'm going to open a brewery. I'm never going to have this funky spelling. Because I'd always call people like, hey, we need this. Yeah. Okay. Doug at the brewery. Yeah. Yes. The brewery, B-R-U-E-R-Y. I was like, I'm never going to do that. That's so annoying. And then after like 6 months of opening Society, I was like, what did I do? I totally forgot the promise I made to myself. So
I like it though, because I'll never forget it.
Yeah. So it really, the E at the end was just to make it unique and cool and kind of stand out.
It worked.
Thank you.
So looking at, I guess one question I had for you says, looking at your site, I can tell that, you know, you guys have been around for, you've been around for about 10 years, correct? So if you've been around for about 10 years, over this time, if you think about it, is there anything particular that you wish that you could have told yourself 10 years ago compared to, you know, from what you know now to what you could have done back then?
From a beer standpoint, no.
No?
From a business standpoint, yes. Delegate as much out as you can. Spend the money to hire anybody who's an expert at what they do that you don't have the time to master. So that could be accounting and marketing and sales, and don't try and do everything yourself. Beer wise, I look at music a lot of, you know, we see at least for me, and I think it's kind of a general sentiment, you see bands and you go, well, you know, their early stuff was the best.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool because when you're young, you don't have the sense of mortality that you do as you get older. You don't have a wife and a mortgage and kids and all these different things. So you kind of just go crazy. You're like, I can do this. It's like this blind ambition. And I think that's one of the greatest things for when society was open was it wasn't like ego or cocky, but it was like, we want to do this. We want to make these beers because this is what we like. Whereas if I had started society today, I'd probably would have been a lot more conservative with the approach. I probably would have spent a lot more time analyzing what to make and looking at numbers. And you just become a lot more risk averse, I think, on the art side okay. as you get older.
Okay. I think, Wendy, pass it back to you.
All right. Hey, so I'm looking at your website, and I think it's really cool that you have the whole team listed. A lot of places don't do that anymore. And I think that this whole industry is about the people in it. That's what makes it interesting to me. I love the three-word descriptions, but I'm curious, did they get to come up with their own, or was it a game like everyone puts a random adjective in and you guys just drew them out?
It's a little bit of both. You know, we get to know the person and we send out questionnaires and say, you know, what's your favorite, this. Then we do it collaboratively. You know, we want their input, obviously, but it still has to be on brand and be specific and kind of fit in. If we let everyone just make up their own, I think we'd have some pretty wild stuff on there.
It was a lot of fun reading it. It really was.
Good. Thank you. Yeah.
So, and I like the fact that you have a position called pint person.
Right.
I actually looked it up to see if it was a term that you guys made up or if it, like what it actually is. So can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Yeah. So when we started, we were going to call them pintsmen. And that was also a made up term, but you're a pintsman. And as time went on, we decided that wasn't fair and inclusive. So as opposed to just removing it and calling them beer tenders, we said you're a pints person. So
I like it.
You're a person who slings pints. And it's just, we get so few opportunities to have fun with certain things in the business world. And I think that's one that we can kind of put our stamp on and say, hey, look, this is us. And, you know, we're not blind to, you know, our first year when it was, you were a pintsman. I think we had pintsmen and like goblet gals. And we just said, everyone is a pints person.
Interesting. So you're in a beer rich city of San Diego with a lot of names that even Michiganders, like a lot of our fans would recognize, like Modern Times, Lost Abbey, Stone, Ballast Point, and a lot more. How do you separate yourself from them?
By trying to be a part of it. And I think that's the best way we've tried to be ourselves is to be part of the community. A lot of people start breweries in San Diego because the beer scene is, like you said, so rich here and there's so many breweries. What you see a lot of times is people just want to kind of take from other breweries and capitalize on everybody else's hard work. And what we did was, hey, let's be part of this. Let's help build this up and give back to the community in every single way. So if we can get more people to drink craft beer, as opposed to just taking craft beer fans from somebody else, then I think it's a win for everybody.
So the people that listen to our show regularly know that I am a, I'd say professional volunteer, but I don't ever get paid. So I don't really know what the word is yet, but what types of things do you do to participate in your community?
We don't since the pandemic, but every month we have a charity month where on Tuesday nights we'd give a portion of proceeds. California law says we can't say how much. But we used to write checks every single month to whatever charity would come out to the tasting room and give out pamphlets. Right now, we host the blood bank every single month. Being involved, really, like how you said, when you're volunteering your time, you're not getting paid for it. So the work we do when we're not sitting at our desk, quote unquote, 9 to 5, helping out, sitting on boards of charities, brewers guilds, events, anything we can do when we're not paid is how we kind of judge ourselves with giving back.
That's awesome. In your most recent Instagram posts, we noticed a lot of beer related books in your collection. Are there any that have truly changed your perspective on beer and the beer and beer making? Sorry.
Yes. Really, there's three. Brew School, which was Brooklyn, Beyond the Pale, Sierra Nevada, Ken Grossman, and So You Think You Want to Start a Brewery, which is Tony McGee, Lagunitas. I think those are great. Coming from people who started breweries before beer was cool and made it through some really hard times, the late 90s was not a good time for craft beer, and they prevailed. And, you know, starting a brewery in 1985 or 1990 didn't mean you're going to be successful. So it's cool to see the evolution of what they've done and hear their stories. And it's just their story. And I think those are pretty cool. I'd say Brew School, I really resonate with a lot just because I moved here from New York City and drank a lot of Brooklyn when I was out there. And Steve Hendy is a big inspiration of mine. So is Garrett Oliver. And I'm happy to call them friends. Tom Potter, too. He co-wrote that and co-founded Brooklyn.
You mentioned that you're a big fan of Belgian beers, and I'm kind of surprised that Michael Jackson's Great Beers of Belgium didn't make that list.
Well, you're talking about the signed copy I have from 1988. Is that what you're talking about?
You might. I might be. I didn't know that you had one. Obviously, you didn't. Go on.
You know, there's stories, which I really like, and then there's, you know, Great Beers of Belgium could be a reference book. And those are the books I really read when I was getting into beer before I started brewing that showed me the world of beer. And not necessarily the business behind it and how to run and operate a brewery.
Is there a style you wish you saw more here in the United States that might be more prevalent within Europe?
Definitely English milds.
Okay.
And Belgian blondes, Belgian ambers, Belgian dark strongs, Belgian golden strongs, triples, table beers. It just 4 out of 5 times I'm drinking a Belgian beer. So that's what I would love to see. But a lot of times the word Belgian is really off-putting, it seems, for some consumers.
Well, it's kind of like the ESB. If you actually say it's a bitter when it's not really bitter, I think it confuses the consumer itself. One thing that I wanted to bring up, I lost track of where I was when I was going to ask this question. So forgive me as I get back to my notes. So a year ago, you were on Beer and Brewing. And they asked you a question and you selected a 6-pack of probably some of the best well-made beers out there. So for those of you who did not listen to that podcast like I did, it was Apt 12, Duvel, Russian River, Redemption, Stone IRS, 3F, Ode Goza, and Pizza Port Swami's IPA. If you had the opportunity, not to replace, because we don't want to say, you know, one got worse or one got better, add a 7th beer. Is there a 7th beer you think you could add to that list that you think would be an amazing beer for your choice?
It's not mine.
That's not yours, no. We know your beer is good.
I would say Lost Abbey Devotion.
Why would you think? Why would you pick that?
Flavorful, low in alcohol. So you can have a bunch of them and not get tanked. And I don't mean, you know, you're crushing them, but like it's something where you can drink them and you want to keep drinking more of them. And it's interesting and complex enough, but still really easy to drink. And every single time you have another sip, you're like, damn, this is still really good. This is awesome. I want to have another sip and I want to have another sip. And it's just a really fun beer to drink.
You mentioned table beers in the question before that I asked, and I'm back on track now. We did a news article a couple weeks ago where the craft beer drinker is going to complete opposite ends. You either want the high as all hell ABV beer or the NA beer. Do you think there is a place within the industry to add table beers to breweries, like low cost, even like just adjunct lagers or adjunct, or not even adjunct, but like an English mild or something like that, something that's easy, cheap to make, and something you could just throw on the table to appease a customer?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big fan of saying, you know, there's times when you drink a beer and there's times when you taste it. And sometimes you just want to drink a beer. And I think those low ABV beers are great. Not us, but people who go for the 8.2% double IPAs and then the NA, it's like, where are we in the middle here? You know, like maybe I want to come home and it's been a hard day and I just want to crack a beer and have two of them and not, you know, I'm getting older. We all are. No one's getting younger. And I want to feel okay tomorrow. So be able to just sit there and drink a beer and kind of have like a thoughtless, like some people watch reality TV shows or some people have other ways of kind of escaping. It'd be nice to have something. And we do it now, but, you know, have a beer that's an accessory to what you're doing as opposed to like the forefront of your mind of what you're doing. I think there is a place, yes. And I really hope as this industry matures and the craft beer consumer matures and, you know, that the industry kind of takes more shape and evolves, that really becomes a thing. And you look at beer drinking cultures, most notably Europe, they all have that. And it's, you know, you go to dinner in Germany, Belgium, UK, and the beer has to be good. You know, quality is a given. But it should not be the focal point of what you're doing. You're there to socialize and eat and be with friends and have just, you know, clock out and have your own like mental health space. So yes, I do. That was a long answer.
No, because I'm going to the opposite end. It's your guys' 10th anniversary this year, and your 10th anniversary beer is a triple IPA. And considered, quote unquote, from you guys, one of the hoppiest beers ever created. Is the West Coast style and this bitter hoppy beer still king out there in California and the West Coast, or are you guys starting to get infiltrated with the hazies?
IPA, West Coast IPA is still rain spring, no doubt about it. Our flagship is the Pupil 7.5%. It's about 65% of our production. You combine Pupil with our specialty releases, which we do every quarter. It comes in at about 85% of everything we make is West Coast IPAs. Hazies are great everywhere. What's cool about beer, and I will bring this back to San Diego and really the West Coast, is that unlike wine, that, you know, to grow the best grapes, quote unquote, you have to be in Napa. With beer, everyone can make it everywhere, which to me means it doesn't matter if it's New England or West Coast or whatever. If it tastes good, it tastes good. So hazies became popular for a reason, and they're very popular out here. They're second to West Coast IPAs, and nationally, that's the statistic too. But yeah, what a hoppy West Coast IPA is, I mean, the standard beer in San Diego.
Now, it says on your LinkedIn page that you are a instructor over at UC San Diego. What do you do over there?
I teach recipe development.
Is there a full-on brew program over there? Is it just like a two-semester setup? How does it work over there at UC San Diego?
It's a full post-grad program. The class I teach is a little different because you don't have to be in the brewing program to take it. It's open to everybody. But everything from the mechanics of a boiler to, you know, the science stuff down to what I'm doing, which is trying to teach art, which is very difficult. Not that teaching mechanics isn't, but it's an incredible program. Also, just for the record, San Diego State has a program too. They call it the Business of Beer. And Cal State San Marcos has one as well. But yeah, the UCSD one is definitely science heavy. So when, even though I'm teaching art, it everybody has a calculator.
Now, when you're building your own business and you're creating your core lineup. So obviously you mentioned the Pupil, which is your top selling. And then of course your seasonals, which kind of covers 85% of your sales. A West Coast IPA in San Diego isn't all that hard. How did you decide on the rest of the beers that are in your core lineup?
Basically anything that supports the Pupil. We make those decisions. It's a collaboration between sales, marketing, and production. So if we look at our IPA, the Pupil, that's kind of like our Heinz ketchup or our Tabasco sauce. And if you look at Tabasco, they've got 20 other flavors. And it's, you hate to say it, but we have a favorite child, but we have other kids there that help that kid out. So it's about getting shelf space. It's about hurdle rate. It's a lot of things that why I hire people smarter than me and better than me at other jobs that kind of make those decisions. So that's how, what it comes down to is what can we make that's one fun for the employees to the brewers, to kind of get creative on, what'll be fun for the people behind the bar to sell that's always new and fresh. What's good for the distributors to sell that's new and fresh, knowing that not that the Pupil sells itself, but, it's the 80-20 rule. You know, we're spending 80% of our time on 20% of our product and just really just trying to keep it fresh, exciting, and new while staying true to society. And it just, it's, I don't say it's easy to make a really good IPA, but, it's what we're good at and the customers seem to like it too. So we're not going to try and do something weird and make a, I shouldn't say weird. I love barley wines, but we're not going to make a barley wine thinking that's going to help a 7.5% West Coast IPA sell. There's a lot of thought and tactics put behind it.
Well, you guys are riding the wave of the Pupil to the point where you guys are actually opening up a second location. What was the choice to open up a second location? Where are you guys going and when should we expect it open?
So yeah, the second location, I think we might be the only brewery in San Diego that didn't have one. Just with the California license, you can get a, what's called a duplicate license. So you don't have to file any new paperwork other than just sending in stuff. Why? I think it's branding. We're pretty centrally located in San Diego in a very industrial area. We've looked at second locations probably starting year two. We've gone down the path about 8 times. I use Stone Brewing Company. The first time they did it, probably 12 years ago, they opened a second location. So for those of y'all, obviously non-San Diego, Stone is up in Escondido. And that's about 45, 50 minutes away from central San Diego. So if you didn't want to haul up there to get a growler of Stone, you could go to one of their urban locations and it looked like Stone. And it, you went in, they had the rebar clothing hangers. Like you walked in, you're like, I'm at Stone Brewing Company. It's like a second Disneyland. You know, if you're in Disney World or Disneyland, it's the same kind of feeling. So I always looked at it as a branding move more than a revenue profit margin grab. Nothing really ever worked until the pandemic when we kind of started to grow quite a bit. And I never wanted to rely on retail. People open tasting rooms because they make a lot of money, but there's also a lot of volatility with retail. Januarys are tough. Septembers are tough. There's a lot of cash being made, but it's not consistent. So society is always focused on wholesale revenue first. With our growth, our tasting room here at the brewery got down to about 5% of our total sales. So kind of my rule of thumb was to keep retail under 10%. So as we've kind of grown the wholesale, I felt more comfortable from a risk standpoint that we could open a second retail location. and not really rely on it and use it more as a, if you don't want to come to Kearney Mesa, which is where we are, which is car dealerships and stereo shops and stuff like that, you can get the society experience somewhere else. Where we're at in San Diego with the second location is an area called Old Town. It's literally the birthplace of California. Tourist heavy, a lot of foot traffic. So if we were to open in other really high density areas like Little Italy or North Park, which is famous, we would just be another bump on the log. Every single, retail establishment is a bar or a restaurant. And we could open there and be successful. But with Old Town, we can contribute to the community and say, hey, yes, we might get some tourists from the restaurants that are there, but what if we bring people to Old Town? What if the restaurant that's in front of us or the cigar bar next to us says, hey, you know what? Thank you for opening here. That was awesome. We have more customers here because now San Diegans are starting to come back to Old Town and it's not just a tourist trap anymore. So that was a big decision of Old Town. I would never want to open close to another brewery. I think it's great for the consumer, but just wanted to do something different. And honestly, being able to contribute to Old Town, be part of the community, have people say, hey, thank you for opening here. You're not just taking customers away from us. You're bringing more customers here. And it's not just tourists anymore. It's locals. That's kind of what we were going for.
So going off of comments you just made of doing something different, looking through your beer lineup, you said IPAs are your bread and butter. But I see this one, I guess, anomaly out there, I guess I'll say, the Butcher, which is kind of the realm where I gravitate towards. What's the story behind the Butcher? If IPAs are your bread and butter, I'm just curious as to how did this come about?
So as Ken said earlier, he gave my six pack on beer and brewing. Stone IRS Imperial Russian Stout was on there.
Yeah.
And even backing up more that, stouts got me into beer.
Okay.
So we had this lineup of IPAs and Belgian beers. And I said, I don't care if this doesn't work. This doesn't need to work. We're making an Imperial Stout. It's in my top three, probably actually. Yeah. In my top three, Belgian beers, IPAs, stouts that taste like chocolate. That's why the Butcher's there. Very much inspired by Stone IRS, Great Divide Yeti, Rogue Shakespeare Stout, Chocolate Stout. Those are the beers that just, I can remember every single one I ever drank. I mean, so we're going to make it no matter what.
So I'm surprised though, because, I can tell your enthusiasm, your love for it. How come we don't see more?
San Diego, it's
just the area.
Okay. I don't know. It's weird. Like we sent beer out to Philly for a music festival out there. It's actually a metal festival. Generally, we send beers. Everybody wants IPAs and hoppy stuff and whatever's new and trendy. Philly went through like half the shipment we sent out there was our Irish dry stout. And I don't know if it's because it's sunny and 72 every single day here, but the weather is not, great for drinking 10% Imperial Stouts.
Okay.
Maybe like 2 days.
I disagree. Every day is a stout day.
That's what I think too. But if y'all come and visit, I mean, there is nothing more San Diego than an IPA and fish tacos. Like that is... If you ever would come February in Detroit, you want to feel the sun's blasting on you and sand between your toes, just do those two things and you'll be right here.
So speaking of coming to visit, I will travel anywhere to try beer. And I'm just curious, what should I tell my friends? Why should my friends come visit you?
Society or San Diego?
You can answer either, but I would prefer society.
Well, I'm going to go with San Diego. It is the highest concentration of world-class breweries in the world. I don't think I have to say that, but it between Ale Smith, Stone, Ballast Point, Carl Strauss, Pizza Port, you name it, Shoot, just to brag, I mean, at the World Beer Cup in April, was it April, right? What month is it? August? It was April. The West Coast IPA style was all San Diego breweries. I mean, gold medal went to North Park, bronze went to Carl Strauss. That's what we do. And you can't go wrong. I mean, if you go to the most touristy spot in downtown and you order a macro light lager, I promise you, they're going to know you're not from here. So you come to San Diego, you can't go wrong. Why society? I don't know. Try us out. I think we do a pretty damn good job. We've done a really good job of establishing ourselves here, and not very much a humble brag, but you want to open a French restaurant in Paris. I mean, that's what we did, and we succeeded. I like to think we're the best, but I put us, you know, the best is a tie at first with about 10 other people. And it's just the greatest beer town I've ever been in. And I have been to about 70 countries, been to 6 continents. I also travel for beer everywhere I go, and I've dragged my wife to breweries everywhere. It's just an incredible thing. And what San Diego also does best is food under $10. I mean, again, fish tacos and IPA. It is, there's nothing like this place, and it is great weather. Every single day of the year. There's no bad time to visit, and there's really no bad brewery to visit.
That's fun.
Are you going to come now?
I am, actually. It's on my list. You already had me won over anyways, but that helped.
Good. Yeah, you can't go wrong. It's paradise. I mean, we live where people vacation. And we have the best beer in the world.
I love how passionate you are about it. That's amazing.
I tell people, people go like, oh, Doug, you're so lucky you found your passion at such a young age. And I'm like, it's beer. I didn't fall in love with copy machines. You know, it's really easy to get passionate about things that are great. And San Diego's awesome. And I think the United States and the rest of the world, there's awesome cities everywhere, but I think it's really easy to get passionate about San Diego. You combine that with beer. It's not hard. Don't think I'm some genius. Or I discovered the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that nobody knows about. And it's.
So just out of curiosity then, how did you end up in San Diego from New York?
Because of the beer. So when I was in New York, there were 4 breweries, and it was between, I wanted to become a brewer. So it was between San Diego and Portland. I had some friends here from college, so that kind of made it a little bit easier. And then I also really liked that San Diego was really heavily focused on production brewing versus brew pubs, which at the time, 14 years ago, Portland was known, brew pub on every corner. And Portland's got an incredible beer scene too, and awesome food and everything. But I wanted to be with the best production breweries. And that's why we started a brewery in San Diego. I wanted to be with the best. You'll never know how good you are unless, you've got the best around you. You can measure yourself with your neighbors. And then also, I don't know, being able to text Tommy Arthur at Lost Abbey's doesn't suck. So it's pretty cool. If we're in the middle of nowhere, I think that'd be a lot harder.
Right.
So that's why San Diego, it's just like a teach me, show me, let me help. What can I do? That's why San Diego. If it were, Newfoundland, I still would have gone there if it were the best beer. But that, yes, again, long answer, short answer, because I saw it as the best beer in the world, and I wanted to be around the best.
Now, a lot of fans of Better on Draft here, obviously, were more relegated to Michigan from the start of the show, but since we've grown when COVID hit, we've expanded nationwide and gotten a lot of people across the nation, but we're still Michigan. You know, you still can't discount 5 years of doing Michigan, mostly Michigan breweries. So I'm sure a lot of people are yelling at you about Grand Rapids right now.
Who's Bells? I've never heard of them. Founders? Who are they?
Founders is some Spanish company. Bells is some Japanese country company now.
Michigan's got an incredible beer scene, and y'all grow really good hops too. We use them.
So in my mind, when you said those things, like the right now to me, beer cities in my head, while I do agree with San Diego, and I have one final question, as we're kind of reaching the end of this, you know, I'm thinking places where I can like really get a good walk around. So Seattle, Chicago, and Asheville were three of the biggest beer cities. Cause when I want to go to a beer city, I don't want to have to drive. I want to be able to go from one to the next without necessarily, without driving. Cause I want to get smashed and go back to my hotel. We're finishing up this. It will let you, finish out with, explaining where you guys are located, social medias, all the fun stuff, that you guys have over at Society. But my final question for you is, the landscape of craft beer over the last just few months has changed drastically, specifically in San Diego. Stone, obviously, we kind of talked about Green Flash a little bit. That was the last couple of years. Ballast Point with the Constellation sale. There's Modern Times. There we go. That was the one I was really trying to think of. With all of this changing, how does the craft beer fan base in San Diego take towards those decisions by those brewers? Like, are they anti, like, oh my God, they're not craft anymore, I'm not going to touch them? Are they, they're still my home brewery, we're going to drink them? How does the fan base locally to you react to those decisions that are made by the brewers?
Yeah, the fan base here, despite acquisitions, they support breweries where the beer is made here. And the employees are local. And as long as people are getting paychecks and they can go visit the breweries, it's never really been a thing. There, you know, some famous acquisitions out there. No one really judged them. We used to host St. Archer after they got bought by Miller Coors all the time here. And the people who worked there before the acquisition are the exact same people who worked here after. And I think the fans are the same way. They just want to drink good beer. I think the beer consumer in San Diego is extremely mature from a life cycle standpoint to go, I don't really care. Does the beer taste good? And are they employing local people? Then I'm going to drink it. Because I want to support San Diego.
I'm sorry. I'm going to pass it to you in 1 second because I want to make a mention. We've talked about it on the show a handful of times, but the last time I went to Asheville and I stopped at Wicked Weed, and it was like 2 weeks after the buyout. And there were a lot of people who were really upset of Wicked Weed's sale to Anheuser-Busch. And the bartender said something that will always stick with me. And he said, I now have health insurance. Yep. And that's not something you normally get within the industry. It's something you definitely, you know, don't necessarily know about. And for that bartender, that made a world of difference because now he is under the Anheuser-Busch umbrella, therefore has health insurance, therefore can do the things that a lot of people don't have the ability to that are in the industry. So as you said, the people are still the same. Most of the time, the brewers are still the same. The bartenders are still the same. The service is still the same. Go on.
I mean, with Wicked Weed, Walt is, I would consider him one of my best friends in the industry. And if there's ever an acquisition, I try to be the first to tell somebody congratulations. Because I know that no one gets, I shouldn't say no one. When people get acquired, that's because they're running a really good business and they care deeply about their brewery. And I want to be the first to tell them congratulations. You know, this is the next step in the evolution of your company. And I think it is great for the employees. what if you have matching 401ks? I mean, how many small mom and pop shops can do that? And for us, I mean, I looked to Southwest Airlines, and this could be another podcast, but Southwest always said employees first, customers second, shareholders third. And we got to take care of those who take care of us. So I think it can be a great thing. It could be a bad thing sometimes too, but I think worse is paying people under the table, not giving them benefits, running around the IRS. And small businesses can make a lot of mistakes, and having that guidance and having access to capital could be a great thing.
So I had two quick questions for you. One, we mentioned a lot about all the great breweries around in San Diego area. Have you done, or do you have any aspirations to do any collaborations with any of these other breweries?
Yeah, we do. We do at least three collaborations a year.
Okay.
We're doing one with another San Diego brewery. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it yet.
Okay.
Ah, screw it. It's Coronado. Whatever. You heard it first here. Yeah, we just we actually brewed our collaboration with Stone 2 weeks ago, and that was post acquisition. If that shows you where I stand, I don't care if Sapporo owns them or if it's, you know, Steve and Greg. It doesn't matter to me. Yeah, we love collaborating. I think it's a great way for our brewers to learn. Since we don't have a pilot system, and it's also a fun way for us to go visit our friends on while we're on the clock. Yeah, that's one of the beauties. You know, everyone says you want to be a brewer until you have to do brewer shit. And it's fun when you don't have to do brewer shit and can kind of like use that part of the business to go, you know, have a beer and check out their system and vice versa. And I think that's the collaboration in this industry is, I think, really at the heart of it. We love doing it, and we love doing it with local breweries too. I mean, society wouldn't be here without a lot of the breweries that we collaborate with.
That's awesome. So for my final question, I mentioned it earlier in the episode about your rally cry, Beer Folk Unite. Do you guys incorporate that somehow in the brewery?
It's all over the walls. I mean, that is, when we give kudos and high fives, it really is Beer Folk Unite. It doesn't matter who you are. It's very much like what the merit of your character and what you're contributing to this company and brewery, and knowing that when you do go above and beyond, that's helping the people around you. And we're all in this for beer. That's just what it comes down to. And very few people get into this because they're not passionate about the product. And, when I have to go through, all these envelopes, as hard as it is sometimes, I know I'm doing it for beer. And I think that's just what it is. And I'm doing it for everybody here. And it really is a team-based effort. And yeah, we have people from all different walks of life, sales executives, investment banker, and just knowing that we're all here for the same reason. And you do it for all the beer folk here.
That's awesome. Wendy?
Speaking of beer, so I'm bringing my girls to visit. What are the two beers that we need to try in your tap room right now?
The Pupil and the Harlot. That's what I'm drinking. That's just because, I mean, this is my baby. People say, I said Pupil's our favorite child, but it is from a business standpoint. It's, I think, ranked 6 on Beer Advocate right now for best IPAs in the world. But this is my daily. Well, I've cut back on drinking every single day. But the days I do drink, this is what I drink. I could spend an hour talking about both beers. I mean, the Pupils, it inspires me every single day. And the Harlot, I think, is a beer that you could drink out of a solo cup, or it could be like it is right now at a 2 Michelin star restaurant in San Diego on a white tablecloth and served in a wine glass. It to me defines, dress it up, dress it down. And also, don't mess with beer. It's already perfect. Don't try and reinvent the wheel. Like it's already the best thing ever. Why try and do all this like wacky stuff? Other than like having fun and seeing what you can do and push the boundaries, that's awesome, because craft beer wouldn't be here without that. But it's like, it's just beer. It's just beer. Or it could be, damn, that is the greatest beer I've ever had in my life. Holy shit. I have never had that pairing with, you know, that beer and that food. This is taking it to another level. So having those two mindsets, and I think both those beers do that.
Fantastic. Ken?
That is going to do it for this episode 295 of the Better on Draft podcast. Society Brewing, where can they find you online and in person?
www.societybrewing.com. 8262 Claremont Mesa Boulevard, San Diego, California, 92111. I'm going to be honest, at Society Brewing with Facebook, Instagram. I think we have a TikTok page. I don't know. I think we do. I don't know if we post anything on there. I don't think we have a Twitter. I don't know. I'm not good at the social media stuff. Next question, please.
You're on the Twitter because I had fun looking at some of your most recent tweets, including there was one. I'm actually going to bring it up and read it real quick because it was hysterical to the point where I just started laughing because I think we've all done it. But it went, new game. You guys know the rules. Step one, put a beer in the freezer. Step two, wait patiently for it to get cold. Step three, promise yourself you won't forget about it. Step four, forget about it. Step five, be surprised and disappointed when it explodes.
Oh, that makes you feel so good because I did that the other night. I'm not alone. I didn't know. I thought I was the only one that did that.
Well,
I do it with wine, with beer. Jeez.
Posted 2 hours ago over on Society at Society Brewing. That's Society Brewing. There we go. We got
it. Society with an E instead of a Y. What's funny is now I look at Society with a Y. I'm like, why is that spelled so weird? It's like, no, autocorrect, you're wrong.
That is going to do it. No matter what you think of your beer, we think it's Better on Draft. Have a good night.
Beer Ace. Folk unite.